Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Greetings and welcome to the Wind Up Podcast, my friends. Happy Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa. It is the last show of 2024 before we get into the new year. And that means it's the last episode in December, which also means it is our monthly Q&A episode that we're getting in today. You've got questions, I've got answers, and if not, I'm just going to make it up and we'll go from there. Just kidding. I won't entirely. Anyway, I'm very excited to get into today's questions. We've got some good ones for you, as usual, that have been submitted online from out at the winery and through our DMs and things on social media. Anytime that you would like to participate in the Q&A, you can contact us through any of those methods, whether you go to our website, that's mtgawines.com. You scroll down on that homepage a little bit, there's a little email box that you can submit questions through and get in touch with us directly. You can also follow us on any of our social networks. We're primarily active on the YouTube and the Instagram. You can slide into our DMs there. You can also find us on the social network formerly known as Twitter and a little bit on the Book of Face as well. One last quick announcement that we are still brought to you by Premier Crew Clothing. That's Premier Crew, C-R-U, clothing.com. You can head to that site, get yourself some nice, kitschy, fun, and interesting wine-related swag, t-shirts specifically. We'll have some new stuff coming out as we get into 2025 as well. You can use the code PREMIER for 20% off your first order on that website there. So go ahead and check that out. I think those are literally all the announcements that we have, which makes me happy. When we can dive right into the episode after like a quick minute of announcements, that makes me really happy. Yeah, that's all we got. All right. Questions. We've got them. You submitted them. We're going to dive into them. This is going to be a fun one. This is probably my favorite episode every month just because it's so varied. We get to kind of go back and recover some topics that maybe we did months ago that someone didn't get to dive into, maybe get into them in a little bit more detail, all of that good stuff. So question number one. Let me go ahead and timestamp this bad boy real fast. All right, and we're starting off with some heat. I like it. What are you and maybe the industry looking forward to in 2025? You know, I'll start with us personally, because that answer is easy, is that I'm really looking forward to the momentum that we've had in the last probably 4 months and seeing how that carries over into the new year. This was, if you listened to the episode last week and kind of the episodes throughout this fall and late summer, you'll probably notice that there's a common theme, that wineries were struggling, the alcohol industry in general is kind of in a weird spot. The industry in Napa specifically, when it comes to tourism, grape growing, sales, everything has been an issue this year for so many people. And realistically, I think that there are a lot of things. I just realized I have my chair behind me and it looks weird. There, now it doesn't look like someone's like creeping behind my shoulder. Sorry about that. The little things you notice when you like stare into a camera and it's basically a selfie you're staring back at as like the preview of the video. And then something's like out of place and you're like, oh, that shouldn't be there. Anyway, distractions. Yay, squirrel. We're going to start that over real quick. 3, two, one, let's do it. All right. You know, there was so much great momentum in the last few months of this year. I think there, and talking to some of my colleagues, friends, and family, they definitely felt that as well, that this year was a struggle in some way, shape, or form for them. You know, very typically, you know, that all boils down to sales and lack of revenue and what you got in the bank to actually continue operating. You know, that's where a lot of us, you know, the rubber hits the road, obviously. The grape growing side of things, of course, it's people, you know, buying that fruit. And if they're not buying that fruit, then obviously you got some tough financial times that you're dealing with because you've spent a lot of money on that farming and now no one wants to buy your produce. That's a tough spot to be in. So a lot of it boils down to that. And when you see the uptick in sales and revenue and everything time to take this nice jump, I mean, we had the best, I mean, the last 4 months has been like the last, since September, October, November, December, those 4 months was the best stretch, not that we've had this year, but probably all time, pretty close. It's certainly the best fall we've ever had, you know, Q3, Q4 that we've ever had. So despite that, though, the year was still down. So what that means is I think people are really looking forward to kind of this reset in momentum and saying, okay, things really in the latter half of 2022 and into 23 really started slowing down. In 24, it hit everybody hard. If it didn't hit you in the prior years, now this is the year that you're going to feel it. And a lot of us felt it, but we bounced right back. And yeah, things are still tight. Things are a struggle a little bit, but we're not, you know, staring down the abyss. Like not knowing which way to go. I think a lot of us have seized on opportunities, whether that's more distribution work, exporting, finding ways to do more events with consumers, participate in things around the country, not just sitting here in Napa and waiting for people to come to us. I think there's been a lot of work and folks have done a lot of due diligence to figure out like, hey, where can we implement some cost cutting, you know, and things like that. This is where you have to be creative. And I feel as though there are plenty of brands that have done that. And there are also plenty who are just still behind the eight ball and really can't get out of their own way, frankly. So personally, and kind of what we're looking for is the continuation of this momentum. You know, I could talk a lot about the wines that we have in barrel, kind of the production and what we're going to be making and the events that we're going to be doing around the country. But realistically, all of that boils down to just the momentum of the industry in general. And we're excited to see where that goes. Now, for the industry as a whole, you know, I think that this is, they would echo kind of some of those same comments. But I think they're trying to find, I'm trying to think if I can word this correctly. I think the industry as a whole is trying to find like the next thing, right? And what I mean by that is like the next trend. You know, back in the 90s, Chardonnay, Merlot, then we had Pinot Noir and red blends. Then we had rosé, champagne, and sparkling wines. Like we've had these kind of like, you know, trendy things that have come up and really been like great boosts and boons to what we do in terms of the style of wines we make, the offerings that we put together. I think, I don't really know what's kind of catching fire right now. And I think as a younger generation and more people get involved with wine, they're looking for things that maybe just aren't what their parents consume. They're not looking for Napa, Cab Sauv, and Chardonnay necessarily. Yes, they may drink those, but they might not be their favorites. They may love some Terroir de Gault. They may love some Pinot Gris and some Chenin Blanc. They could really enjoy some Tannat or some Cabernet Franc. Like they might be looking for things that are maybe a little bit off the beaten path. And I think that's what the industry is looking for in 2025, is trying to figure out, like, what is the next step? Like, we've all kind of been gut punched by this year, and we're kind of looking for that next thing that we can jump on. And I don't know if the industry knows that just yet. I also think the industry as a whole is starting to look for more transparency, as we've talked a lot about on this show. There are more and more consumers that are way more interested in what they're actually consuming and what goes into making the bottles of wine that they consume. They want that great story. They want that great experience. And that is becoming paramount for brands. So the industry as a whole is looking for that stuff to grab onto and be like, this is what we need so that we can become the wine industry of the future and not just stay as sticks in the mud where we are and where we have been, frankly, for decades. That's kind of like my, you know, testing the wind out to see if you're, see which way it's going. Honestly, if I had a crystal ball and I knew what we were looking forward to, you know, obviously we'd be much more well off. But this is something that I think those are like kind of the main kind of, you know, 36,000 foot view points that we're all looking forward to as we get into the new year. Absolutely. And that's, of course, like outside of the wines that we're currently making, the new vintages of 2023 that we're going to be bottling up, and the 24s that are just getting, you know, into their aging process. Like, there's a lot of exciting stuff coming down the pipeline from some pretty good vintages, but there's a lot of other things in the background that need to be there and that we need to focus on to make sure those vintages actually end up where we want them to be. All right. Excellent, excellent start to the show. All right, question number two, diving right into it. We're just going to go for it. All right, and actually kind of in relation to that first question as well. It sounds like wineries are regularly behind the eight ball when it comes to planning and financial success. Why is that? Is there a common thread between the tough years? Assuming that you're not talking like growing seasons when it comes to like tough years and things, and this is, you know, more of like the business, you know, finance planning side of things question. Because the tough growing seasons are, you know, typically like out here, it's a short answer, like typically cold, rainy weather, basically. When it comes to like the business and financial planning, quite honestly, I do not get the sense that wineries really know how much they're spending and where that money is going, and if there's actually an ROI on the money that they're spending. Like, if you're buying 100% new oak barrels, you know, every year, you don't use any used barrels, you don't use any stainless steel except for maybe fermentations, is that a good return on your investment? Are you actually making really outstanding wine and selling out of it because of all this new oak, or is it just kind of a marketing thing? And is that marketing, and if it's just a marketing thing, is that marketing expense, does that make sense? You know, if you're buying new equipment, do you need to be buying new equipment? Do you actually know what your cost of goods are when it comes to the bottle of wine that you're producing? Do you know what it costs you to go to an event and pour wine at an event around the country, or even just host a tasting at the winery? Do you understand, like, when someone sits down at your property, that there's a cost associated with that, and do you know what that is? When it comes to shipping, do you understand that if you discount shipping or discount your wine, you know, do you understand how that hits your margins and your bottom line in the long run? And it seems to me that there are many wineries that just don't get that kind of stuff. It's really funny. And this is a question kind of associated with this question, because this is I'll tack on one that we get every once in a while, and it's why don't we do, especially around the holiday season, around like, you know, Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Small Business Saturday, like whatever it is, like the reason why we don't do any like discounts or deals is because we don't plan for that in our budget. And here's what I mean by that. If for those of you that aren't sure, there's probably some of you that are like, okay, here comes the, you know, 101 accounting course. But for those that don't understand like how this works when it comes to a business, here's how we're going to lay it out for you. Anytime a business, I always call this kind of like the JCPenney style of marketing. Some of you probably don't even know what JCPenney is or was, but in essence, if you're not sure, it's a big discount brand store. You walk in and you see a price tag on a thing and it's like, oh, this was $80, but it's half off here. And guess what? There's an extra 20% off that. So it goes from, you know, $50 down, you know, $80 down to $50 down to whatever 20% of 50 is. I haven't finished my coffee yet. I'm not doing math just yet today. So, you know, it's only $40. Oh no, sorry. That would be, yeah, it's $10 off. I'm a dumb. So it's $40 instead of $80. Or sorry, it's $40 instead of, God damn it. Now, see, this is why I wasn't going to do math, and now I confused myself. I said I wasn't going to do math. I haven't finished my coffee yet. For those watching, I got my coffee cup. I got my French press right next to me when I need a refill. Like, we're doing this. It's 9:30 in the morning. I shouldn't be this sleepy, but it's the holiday season. What are you going to do? All right. Basically, the prices in those stores, the point is that the price, they show you the high price because they're using that discount as a marketing tool. right? It's the same thing that Amazon Prime does with shipping. Believe it or not, when you order stuff from Amazon Prime, you are paying for shipping. It's just not a line item on your receipt. It's factored into the price of all of the goods that they sell. That's how they get around, that's how they offer free shipping, is they say, hey, we know what this is gonna cost, and we're just gonna roll that into our budget and the cost and the pricing on our site, and it'll even itself out. They take it into account. And that's what JCPenney does as a discount like retail shop. They say, hey, we know that people come here because they, quote, want a great deal on something. When they see it's $80 and it's half off and another 20% off that, they know that they're getting a great deal. They tried to not do that and it failed miserably. They had to go back to this discounting model. But that's part of their budget. That's part of their business plan, is to do this discount marketing. And believe it or not, the price that they're getting, even at the discounted price, that's the price they want, because they're going, they're just playing a volume game. And they're like, we can operate on these really low margins. We don't need to sell this for $80. We can sell this shirt for $5, because if we sell 500 of them, we make good money. Or 5,000 of them. I mean, it scales up really, really large, okay? Like big money, big, big volume. That's how like discounting works, how it should work, I should say. The issue when it comes to like the financial planning, like wineries being behind the eight ball, is that when people get to these tight spots in the industry, you saw this during the recession, in 08 to 11, you're seeing some of it now, where people are using things like Last Bottle, Wine Spies, Wine Access, like kind of these big discount shops and online stores, or even through distribution and through wholesalers like a Costco or a Total Wine, where they're discounting their wine quite a bit so that they can move that volume. The issue is that they haven't accounted for that when it comes to their business planning. So their margin, they're moving great volume, but their margins are way smaller. So they have less cash coming in than they would if they had sold it through like a direct program or wine club or whatever it might have been. So it's stuff like that, that it just seems like wineries don't quite grasp. We had this issue at a former job that, you know, our online sales, and this was the job before I started working for myself, like our online sales, you know, really hinged for this brand on discounts, on shipping and on product. And sometimes we would marry the two and say, hey, if you're buying, you know, $100 worth of product, then we'll give you half off shipping. If you buy $200 worth of product, then it's 10% off and half off shipping. Like, you know, we'd do these like combo deals, right? And the problem was, is that every single year, at least when I was there, we were way over budget when it came to our shipping costs. And it was like, well, why is that? It's like, well, because you're not collecting any revenue from these orders and you're having to spend money on shipping. Like, it costs us money to ship wine. In fact, it costs us more than what we charge you. We're just trying to make up a lot of the difference. Like, we have, like, it's still like anytime we charge for shipping in this industry, like, we're not making up the entire difference. You know, if there's an address change or anything associated with that, we get charged like an extra $30 on top of that. Like there's all these like little things that we get nickeled and dimed on, and we never cover the cost of shipping. It's just, we're trying to like stop the bleeding, basically. So if you don't take that kind of stuff into account, you start hemorrhaging. Like, that's just how it is. So, you know, that's kind of a long-winded example, but that's why wineries suck at the business and the planning side of it, because it's very typically, many of them just don't understand like how that kind of stuff impacts their business. We said this in the episode last week, is that, and I've said it today, that we've had the best like 4-month run that we've probably ever had. But why are we still down on the year? Because the first part of the year was really tough, but it's also because we did our wholesale sales and selling to distributors went from like 1-2% up to like 7 or 8%. That's a big jump. And the margins on that sucks. It just does. As much as we love being in some of the markets and doing some of the events that some of you all attended, actually, you know, it's kind of like, we got to move this wine somehow. Like, we can't just have it sitting here collecting dust. Let's try and get it out and in front of some people. And yeah, the margins are terrible. And we've sold more bottles than we ever have, and we're still down on the year. But, you know, that's you just got to bite that bullet. We need cash on hand so we can pay our harvest bills. You know, that's the reality of the situation. And we knew that full well when we made that choice. And we were very aggressive with our pricing, very protective of our brand, and said, hey, if we're going to do this, we understand the financial burden that this is likely going to put on us. But again, cash is king sometimes, and you need to get that cash flow moving. So it was, even though it's not a hugely profitable segment of our business, in fact, it barely is, you know, it's still something that can be beneficial for our brands. I have a buddy of mine that is going through that kind of thing right now, where they created, in essence, a second label for distribution. And they ended up, I think they ended up like moving it all through like Costco or Total Wine or something like that. They took like a huge thing of it. And if you don't know, if you're working with like those two big ass retailers and many big like chains like that, you're going to have to give them like the ultra special double secret probation, top secret pricing. Right? Like that's, you're going to have to like discount way below what you would normally do. Otherwise they're just not going to pick it up. And he is of the opinion that for the brand he works for, that if they're not making a minimum of $30 a bottle margin, that it's not worth it. Like that's not going to support the brand. Which means this is roughly I think it's like an $80 or $85 bottle of wine we're talking about. So if they're going through a distributor, like they're probably going to have to, or a broker to do this, they're discounting that wine. Let's say it's $80. They're discounting that wine to $40. At a minimum, $40 a bottle at a minimum, just so this, you know, place will pick it up and sell it. And I guarantee you, if it was going through like a Costco or a Total in a big volume, they probably had to go below that, which means they were probably right up against their cost of goods. Because if there was, you know, we've talked a lot about the pricing of Napa Cab, what new barrels cost. Like, it's really easy for a bottle of wine in Napa to cost, just for the, you know, minus like the labor, the land, like all the others. I mean, I guess the land is, you know, and farming is taken into account and when it comes to the cost of the grapes, but it's really easy to get to a bottle that costs like $40. So they very well could have lost their ass on that deal. But again, if it's just going to sit there in a warehouse and collect dust, you might as well get it moving somehow. But they didn't plan for that. They thought, hey, if we can get like this certain margin, that would be really nice. It turned out that wasn't what they were able to get. And that's about as much as I know of that particular story. But it's like, oh, well, yeah, this obviously didn't work because you don't understand how this game is played. And maybe you do, and it just didn't work out the way you thought it would. Fair enough. Like, some, obviously, you know, in business, we throw stuff at the wall sometimes and it just doesn't stick. So this is a really broad, like open-ended question, like long story longer, is that there are plenty of reasons why wineries struggle. 99 times out of 100, it's because they simply don't stop to think about how something is going to impact their business, and they haven't planned appropriately. Like, just plain and simple. Like, it's really basic business planning type stuff, and there are a lot of very talented people in this industry. And there are a lot of really amazing business owners, like people who have done incredibly well in other industries, whether they're doctors or lawyers or in tech or whatever, like very smart people are drawn to this industry to make wine. And somehow, when it comes to this business, people just, it, like, they shit the bed when it comes time to have these kinds of conversations. It's very strange, and I cannot for the life of me figure it out. And it's frustrating. Because, you know, it is, we don't have the perks of like being subsidized like Europe does. Like, we have to carry our own crop insurance. Like, and if there's, and this is like the NVV is trying to change this and stuff. That's the Napa Valley Vintners. But we're trying to get like grants and stuff from the federal government to help us with fire prevention, fire damage, like all this other stuff. Like, none of that's ever been covered for us. Like, we get caught holding the bag all the time. And when we've invested so much time and money into something that doesn't work out and we have an issue, it's like, ugh, like we take it on the chin, you know, where, you know, if the crops go bad in like a Burgundy or something like that, like that's like the French government like does a lot to cover that wine industry and limit their liability. That's not how it is here. It's why you can find, and you know, it also helps that, you know, when you have generational owned businesses that have been around for a while, like the cost of that land and doing that business is a lot less, you know, where if you're buying into the industry now in Napa and you're paying $100 million for a facility and or hundreds of millions for a facility and all that stuff, I mean, it's a different thing. And some will argue, it's like, oh, it's on the balance sheet. It's fine. It's an investment. I'm like, yes, it is an investment because you're buying this property and this land and all this other stuff. But in theory, you still got to make this business profitable. And if you're ending up, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions in the hole right out the gate, like being successful financially is really, really tough. It's really, really tough. You know, maybe you get there eventually. You know, but you're going to have to really scale up, or you're going to have to charge a boatload for your wine if you're going to stay small. There's so many like complexities. And frankly, I think it just comes down to poor planning. You know, a failure to plan is a plan to fail, basically kind of situation. And there are certain brands that typically fail upward. Like we all know those people in life that just tend to fail upward. Like they just... we can't explain it. It's like, you're just kind of like you're a good person, but you kind of suck at what you do. And somehow you're in charge of like projects and stuff. Like, how does this happen? You know, it's just kind of the way it goes. Sorry, I need some more coffee. R2 is going to give me some more coffee here. For those that aren't watching, you're just listening. I have this giant R2-D2 French press and he's adorable and he makes coffee for me. Thanks, R2. Hopefully that answers the question. Because when it comes to planning financial success, like we always start behind the eight ball, because if you don't have wine to sell right out of the gate, there's no revenue coming in, right? If you don't have grapes to sell right out of the gate, there's no revenue coming in. So it could take 2, 3, 4 years before there's any cash flow in a wine business. So you're already behind the eight ball. And then when it comes to, you know, the planning and whether it's the discounting models, or expenses, or COGS, I mean, whatever it is you're working on, if you're not doing a really great job of understanding and doing those things, then that just compounds, right, and creates more issues. So that's really why wineries tend to struggle, in my opinion, is simply lack of planning and an unwillingness to kind of buck trends and just throw stuff at the wall. I think this is a very, you know, rooted in tradition industry, which can be tough to buck sometimes, and you need to do things differently, and you need to find what works for you. You can't look at other brands and be like, we're just going to do that. They're doing the great job. We're just going to copy paste that here and make it work. I see that all the time, and it fails miserably. All right. Hopefully that was kind of an all over the place kind of answer, but hopefully that did the trick. Question number three. All right. Oh, this is a little bit more of a practical question, which I always like these because it kind of breaks up the intense, you know, winemaking, business planning, all the things talk. We're shopping for wine glasses. Any suggestions? Should we invest in a decanter while we're at it as well? What do you recommend? Let's see. Actually, I just realized when I saw my chair and I had to move it away from me earlier, I have my, if you can see it on the video, it's right there, a box of Riedels that have to go back to the winery. Not that I'm a huge Riedel fan. They do the job they need to do. If you're shopping for wine glasses, let me see if I can bring up like a photo of them, because that'll make this easier. Because you don't need to buy like the biggest, fanciest, you know, thing. You really don't have to. The big thing I say you need to look for, of course their website doesn't work, lovely, is realistically just the size of the glass. That's really the big thing for me. Oop, that's not what I want. Is this what I want? Oh, that's not gonna do it. No, this is not working. So actually, let's just bring up Riedel's site. Hold on. If you're watching this, I suggest watching this part because I'm actually going to like show you what's going on. Let me move my notes. Let's move this thing. All right, there we go. Boom, there we go. So this is the Readle website. Like, you know, and they're always like, the ads are just hilarious, number one, so funny. But there's all kinds of different shapes, sizes. You could also do, I like these glasses as well, Gabrielle Glass. They're really nice. Realistically, like, because there are folks that are like the collections, right? Where it's like, okay, let's say we want the performance collection right here. And it's like, okay, we have the performance collection, but now we have all these different shapes and sizes within it. Like, there's one for Merlot, there's one for Pinot, there's one for Syrah. Actually, Syrah's not that bad as long as it's from the Rhone Valley. Riesling, you know, you have Champagne. Then you have, you know, like something like Gabrielle Glass, which is like a little bit more of the stunning universal stemware, they call it, you know. Realistically, something that has like roughly this shape, it's the reason why I love this shape of a glass. It doesn't have to be this brand. It doesn't have to be Riedel either for that matter. But you can see like something that bows out and has like a lot of volume to it. It's not because you're going to pour yourself a country club pour. I mean, do pour yourself a country club pour if you decide to. But it's just to make sure that you can aerate the wine and swirl it efficiently to volatilize everything in there and get the, you know, the aromas and everything kind of funneling out of the glass. In that same light, you want it to taper. You can kind of see here in all this glassware that it kind of funnels and it tapers towards your nose. That way it concentrates right there. The same thing is true of these glasses. Like it gets the rim is smaller than the base, right? Narrower than the base, which allows everything to kind of get funneled right into your olfactory senses and allows you to really experience more of the wine. Do you need to go out and buy a different glass for every variety? No. Does glassware make a difference in the wine? Yes. Does it matter? Maybe. Okay? Like I am a bit of a Pinot Noir snob, so I do use Pinot Noir glasses when it comes to that wine. For almost everything else, I use basically a Cabernet or Merlot glass, a Bordeaux style glass. Like these are really the two stems that we use. We do have some white wine glasses, like just for like pomp and circumstance and like entertaining. Like that's always nice to have as like a great option, but not necessary. Like these two, like for, and the reason is like the big wider bases, the wines that can really benefit from more air and are just more aromatic in general. I love these bigger, wider glasses to get kind of more of that going on and swirling it a little bit more and aerating it. Where if it's something that's maybe a little tighter, I still want a big glass so it aerates, you know, efficiently. But, you know, still just kind of funnels all that to your nose. I mean, realistically, it doesn't matter. Just find a glass that you like and stick with it. Like if typically when I'm doing blending sessions, I'll put it this way, I'm using just this like standard like Riedel style Cabernet or Merlot glass because I just want that kind of simplicity. We do not have like 8 different types of glassware. That would be ridiculous. I mean, fun when you show up to a dinner party and there's, you know, all kinds of like cool stemware and things. It's a great tasting experience as well. If you're at like a nice restaurant or something, you get to like experience the wine and like the correct glassware. Like it's really nice. It's a very nice touch. Is it necessary for you at home? Probably not, unless you're a wine geek like us and you want to kind of experience that. The glassware does make a difference. I always suggest something with a nice kind of wide base to it that has that nice taper to the nose, so you really get to experience the wine in full. The big like goblets that don't taper at all are a pain. They're a nightmare. You need something that can hold like a decent amount of volume so you can really swirl it because that's really important in the wine experience, in my humble opinion. So that's really what I would go with. As far as investing in a decanter, I really don't decant any of my wines. The reason why I don't is because I like to experience the wine evolve in the glass. Decanting for me, it's again great pomp and circumstance. It's a great presentation, and if it's an older vintage that may contain some sediment in there, it's a great way to make sure that sediment doesn't end up in your glass. But even then, it's like, if you end up with some sediment, you just rinse it out a little bit with the next wine and call it good. Like, it's not that big of a deal. Decanting can, if it's a really young, or if it's a really tight wine that needs a lot of aeration, then yeah, decanting can obviously help. But for like me personally, I just make sure I have a nice big glass like we were talking about, and I just do a lot of swirling. It's the same thing. Decanting, I think, is, it's again, more for me personally, it's more for show and more for removing sediment from older vintages. It's very, very practical. For younger wines, I typically don't decant at all. But again, this is very subjective. If you love the pomp and circumstance of decanting, I mean, go for it. It's a beautiful like ceremony to like open up a bottle of wine, like present it to folks. Shoot, I used to, there was a while I got on like a sabering kick, like when it came to like opening bubbles. Like I would put a bottle of bubbles like neck down in ice in the freezer for like 30, like 20 minutes, something like that. And I would just saber bottles nice and clean just because you can, because it's fun and it's exciting and all these things. So there's like these things, it's like, is it absolutely, is that necessary to open a bottle of bubbles? No, but it's a shit ton of fun. So go for it, you know. Find some glasses that you like, that look cool, that have that nice wide base, that taper to the nose, and that you love to look at. And you'll be just fine. Could be Riedel, could be Gabriel Glass, could be any of the other crystal glass producers. I mean, they all do a pretty decent job. All right, I think we got time. We got a little bit of time left. Let's do one more, shall we? One more question. Question number 4. During this slower season, what is going on in the cellar and what are you looking for in the wines? Oh, okay. Now, this time of year, for those of you watching and for those of you listening, this time of year, like I'm still in my sweats. Okay, like I have my slippers on, I got a beanie, a nice little jacket on. Like I'm having just a nice, cool, calm, relaxing vibe today, post holiday season. And this is typically the vibe in December and into the early part of January. During this slow time of the year, we're checking in on the barrels. I'm out at the winery maybe every other day, every couple of days. Just making sure that one, like barrels aren't leaking, that everything's topped up, that the bungs aren't popping out if the malolactic conversion is happening, or if there's anything that was still a little sweet that was fermenting. Like it's just like dotting I's and crossing T's to make sure that we're getting ready, that we're going to be in a good spot to plan for our rackings in the first couple of weeks of January and then eventually bottling in February. I'm just kind of chilling. This is pure quality control. You know, at the beginning of the month, I tasted through a bunch of barrels just to make sure that they're in a good spot. We did some blending trials at the beginning of the month, and last week even. Like, there's just like little, it's like the to-do list in the cellar is pretty short right now. That's all going to change in about 2 weeks, and it's going to become a lot busier as we start really getting ready for bottling and getting these blends put together. We have to get all of our 2024s racked and kind of put to bed to remove all the heavy leaves and sediment. We're going to go ahead and make sure that gets done pretty efficiently this year. We try to do it, you know, kind of that second week of January, as long as the wines are ready for it. I'll go through and taste everything beforehand just to make sure they need it. And if not, we'll just let them sit. You know, it's a very kind of like lackadaisical vibe right now for us. And I don't know if it's like that for everybody, but I think this is when us winemakers try to just like chill. The wines are safe. They're sound. They're in barrel. We're good. The harvest went well. We're just trying to relax. So what we're looking for in the cellar and what's going on is just QC. That's all that we're doing right now. There might be some cellar work in terms of like racking and moving wine and getting barrel programs dialed in, maybe some blending, getting prepared for bottling runs. But there's not a lot of heavy lifting right now, which is really, really nice. When it comes to the wines themselves and what we're looking for, it is where we try and kind of find the vibe of a vintage. So like with the new wines from 2024 that are in the cellar, I'm tasting through them to kind of figure out like, where is this vintage headed? Like, what does it compare to from prior vintages? And what is it kind of, I'm trying to shake my crystal ball a little bit and figure out like where those wines are headed. Like what qualities do they have? What can we expect? I'm just trying to get a good like 36,000 foot view of like what's the deal here. With other wines, like with the 2023s that we still have in barrel that we're going to be bottling this next year, you know, we're going to be bottling some of those in February. We're going to bottle the rest of them in August, so they even have like quite a few more months before they're going to be ready to go. And at this point, it's almost like raising a kid. Like, we don't have kids, but like this is what I kind of assume is like you kind of see them come into their own and form their own opinions and quirks and all this other stuff at some point. And that's kind of where the wines are right now. They're very kind of much in this adolescent phase of like, they've figured out kind of who they are to a certain extent, but they don't know it yet. And that's going to continue to evolve and change over time. And we're just kind of being a guiding hand. You know, we're just trying to make sure that these wines that have been in barrel now for over a year are going to continue to stay kind of on the right track, and that where they're going to end up where we want them to end up. But it is, we don't want to force the issue. We want to still let kind of creativity and kind of the art form ride and let the wines not make themselves, but we don't want to force the issue. You know, we're not trying to make Coke or Pepsi here. Like, we're not trying to homogenize our wines and make them taste the same year in and year out. So we want some of this little bit of vintage variation. And it's very comparable to what we do with the new vintages. We taste through everything. We're just like, okay, is this really, like, are the 23s, does it taste like a 2023? Is it showcasing kind of what we would expect from this vintage, or is it different somehow? And as we start putting together the blends for these wines, like, can we make sure that they tie to both past vintages as well as future vintages that we've made and are currently making? So it's a lot of QC. It's a lot of wine tasting. It's a little bit more lackadaisical. I don't have to wear my heavy work boots as much. The hours are a little bit shorter, which is lovely. In fact, I'm going to try and take the rest of the week off. So with that, we're going to wrap up here. I love you guys. I hope you've had a very, very merry Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Boxing Day, whatever you got going on. Hope you have an excellent finish to the year of 2024. I don't know why I said it like that. That was kind of dumb. Whatever. I hope you have an excellent finish to the year. We have actually a very exciting episode next week. We're going to dive into a little bit more of what we talked about with the first two questions at the beginning of the show, kind of the future of the wine industry and where things are headed and kind of the generational gap that we're seeing and how wineries are both struggling to adapt to what is coming down the pipeline with this new year, but also what some of us are, in fact, excited to see. So love you guys. Have an excellent rest of your day. This has been the Wind Up Podcast. Be sure to follow us on all of our social networks, at MTGA Wines, on the Book of Face, the social network formerly known as Twitter, Instagram, and of course on YouTube, where you can find the video version of this show, tasting notes, and all kinds of good stuff on there. Be sure to check out Premier Crew, CRUclothing.com, to go get 20% off your first order with the code PREMIER. Last and certainly not least, there was one other thing. What is it? It's on the tip of my tongue. Oh, yes. Be sure to rate, review the show wherever you're consuming your podcast. That really helps with the good old algorithm and getting it out into the airwaves. We appreciate you. Have an excellent rest of your day, and we will see you next week on the Wind Up Podcast. Cheers.